Today's episode of Beyond the Mask is presented by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. Get a free consultation today to be guided through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Just visit crnafinancialplanning.com. Beyond the Mask is also sponsored by crnaeducation.com. CRNAs, you can get the CE credits you need by just going to crnaeducation.com. They have over 100 AANA prior approved credits, all four core CPC modules, and even over 40 pharmacology credits. No subscriptions, it's all online and mobile friendly. Just go to crnaeducation.com. And don't forget, listening to our podcast can earn you Class B credits. For more information on how you can submit them, check out our CE credit tab on our website, beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Welcome to the Beyond the Mask podcast. This is the Anesthesia Alchemy Edition, Terry and Gary Unplugged. Join hosts Gary Bridges and Terry Wicks as they deep dive into today's most important clinical conversations in a unique but educational way, in a humorous balance that only they can achieve. Let today's journey begin. Here are Terry and Gary with your next installment of Anesthesia Alchemy.
3, 2, 1.
All right, here we go. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, faithful listeners, here we are at another episode of Anesthesia Alchemy, Gary and Terry, and we are really unplugged today. So, and today we're going to dive into a pretty interesting topic. We're going to go through some medical legal considerations. We're going to talk a little bit about being an expert witness and what all that entails. And we're going to talk about anesthesia standards, and I think that's critical. And particularly, we're going to focus on the standards that have been created and published by the American Association of Nurse Anesthesiology. We're going to share some of our own experiences as acting as expert witnesses in medical legal complaints filed on behalf of patients. And perhaps, and just as important, though, we're going to talk to you about some ways that you can keep yourself out of hot water and keep your patients safe.
Yeah. Woo. Wow, Terry, you know, it is a lot to unpack in one episode, but I think it's important, you know, as providers, we periodically review those standards by which we're expected to practice. And it's very easy to overlook over time when you get through your profession, moving through your career, you know, so both for the benefit of our patients also. I mean, that's the primary reason we need to be really cognizant of our standards and reviewing them and updating them, of course. You know, and also to make sure that we're actually practicing to the highest level of anesthesia care every single day. And as we have in our taglines, every single second, because, you know, every beat counts, right? So, Terry, tell us a little bit about how you got involved in acting in as an expert witness.
Well, you know, Gary, it really was. It was an accident and a coincidence. When I first moved to North Carolina in the very early 90s, I was up in Banner Elk, North Carolina at an anesthesia meeting, and I was giving a presentation on a brand new drug, which I currently wouldn't use to save my life, called Mivacurium.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Slow onset, short duration of action. It's like an old man on a date.
That's right. And I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Well, it ain't because you're paralyzed. It's because your lungs are...
You're just having a little bit of histamine release. But don't worry about it. That'll clear. But anyway, there was a CRNA at the meeting named Rosie Stamey, and she was getting ready to retire. And she'd been contacted by an attorney from up in Marion, North Carolina, named Penn Dameron, who currently, I think, sits on the bench. Rosie didn't want to take on that case because it takes a while to negotiate them to finish. And so she suggested that the attorney reach out to me. And it was a case involving a pediatric airway misadventure. So I reviewed the case. And like I said, that was 30 years ago. And over the course of the ensuing 30 years, I guess I've reviewed dozens and dozens of cases, often dozen a year. But fortunately, I only had to testify at trial 6 or 7 times. And so that's kind of how I got to this place. And I think I've just about got my desk cleared off. I may have one or two brewing in the background. You know, you never can tell. But Gary, you've done some medical legal work. Tell us a little bit about your experience and how you got into it.
Yeah. You know, my experience dates all the way back to even when I was an ICU nurse. And it was kind of an interesting story. I hadn't even been in nursing practice for maybe 2 or 3 years at this point. and get this phone call. Hey, there is a patient that, you know, living in South Texas, you know, the snowbirds come down. We've certainly double in population just after, you know, Thanksgiving until about Easter. Mm. And so we don't have the best plasma down there during that time. So
things are a little thin.
A little thin, yeah. The attorneys call and they kind of have a conversation with a number of the ICU nurses. And the majority of the ICU nurses that were being interviewed were very, very defensive, if you will. This was when, you know, almost nobody was using electronic health records, and we were actually the test site for Hewlett-Packard for their system, which I thought was great, was called CareView. The defense attorneys were like, you know, hey, Gary, you seem to be very interested in this stuff. And I said, well, I mean, you hear about it all the time. We read about it in our journal articles. It doesn't freak me out. Yeah. But, you know, I think it behooves us to sort of review sort of what our standards of care is, what the Nursing Practice Act says, what we must, you know, uphold. And so anyway, this, I go through deposition. Basically, the case is patient comes in, you know, it's obviously this time of year and in the wintertime in South Texas, it's always typically a cardiac event. She didn't do very well. She was hospitalized for quite some time. Smoke, you know, you paint all the comorbidities, right? Smoker, doesn't exercise, you know, the whole nine yards.
A monument to fitness.
Yes, a monument to fitness with the advent of emphysema. Yeah, so anyway, she has her course of events in the ICU. Ends up, she has been bedridden for quite some time in the hospital, starts to develop decubitus ulcers on her spine, and you know, she has multiple surgeries for that. And then she spent some time in the neuro ICU and then came back to the surgical ICU and back and forth. Anyways, so they decide they're going to sue the hospital. And so we go through deposition, then they go to trial. And I'm like, oh man, I don't have enough PTO to go to trial.
this could take weeks.
That's right. So anyways, the hospital's like, oh no, you're covered. You're going to go do the defense for, you know, obviously yourself as well as the ICU. So fine. So we had sort of the Doogie Howsers of attorneys here in Texas that were defending the hospital. And the one guy, so I'm sitting up in the courtroom with our defense team. The plaintiff attorney is like, well, why is he? He's an expert witness and a defendant. And so the attorneys go up. There's like, can we approach the bench judge? And they go up and they show a specific clause in the Texas statute that if you designate an individual as a corporate representative, then they get to sit the entire trial.
Ooh, that's kind of cool.
Well, I had all the ammunition before I got called up to the witness stand. So they designated me as the corporate representative and as well as an expert. And so I got to listen to the entire trial. And one of the complaints, which amongst many in the trial by this patient, was that she was intubated and laying in excrement for prolonged periods of time, which contributed to her skin breakdown, etc., while being intubated and restrained. So she couldn't, she said she would scream out and she would grunt to get people's attention, and nobody would pay attention to her. And so they called me up to the witness stand. And, you know, one of the first things the attorneys will tell you is when you're in trial, it's a theatrical performance. And so, you involve that jury. So, you know, they're trying to pinpoint me on some places in the chart. And I said, well, you know, if the jury's, I mean, this is a complex sort of thing with electronic health records because it's so new. I said, I need to show the jury one by one what is in the chart and what does it mean by omitted, which is kind of like putting a line through an error in the chart and then initialing it and calling it an error. Anyway, so we get through that. And then the plaintiff attorney says, you know, so she rehashes the grunting and the laying in fecal excrement and nobody coming around. She make it sound pretty dismal. And I said, you know, it's really unfortunate. I could imagine how afraid that patient would be, intubated, being aware, restrained. But I said, is it possible to grunt around the tube? And I said, well, I have to pause for a little bit and actually explain. Is it possible? Well, in some cases, if the cuff is reduced, maybe. But I said, I couldn't tell you that for sure. But so she would not let me answer sort of the extra details that I wanted to provide. And the judge was like, you know, answer yes or no. That's what, and I said, you know, judge, I took an oath. There's a little bit more explanation that needs to be done so that the jury gets a full picture of what's going on. Anyway, long story short, defense team comes up, asked me to go ahead and share the story. And I said, well, the FDA, which is pretty stringent in what we do in care, and for us to hook any type of mechanical apparatus onto a patient, there has to be certain thresholds that are set. So, you know, could you generate a big pressure in the intrathoracic cavity or your chest? The answer is yes. If you attempted to try and grunt around the endotracheal tube, I said, you would have to create such an excessive force that it would get transmitted to the ventilator, and every single alarm would go off on the ventilator. Not only would you have the nurse, you'd have the respiratory therapist, you'd have the physician, you'd have everybody looking over and helping. So laying in her excrements for hours, as she notes, I said, that's false. Not possible. Particularly when the machines are going, because I said, these are so high pitched, they're so irritating that you're going to look and you're going to come over and address the issue.
Well, pretty hard to ignore.
Yeah, exactly. And so anyway, the plaintiff attorney threw the chart across the courtroom, expressed a few explicitives, and the husband got up and ran out the back of the courtroom and was saying, oh, this is BS, this is BS. And I'm like, you know, so they ended up, I think there were 7 charges against it. Everything was dropped with the nurses. Pain and suffering, I think she got something for, and then there was one other element that that they actually got judgment on, and I don't even think it covered their expert witness fees. But anyways, it started there, and somehow I got involved with some other ones while I was in school, and then I got a call from the Texas Attorney General to do some, or their office, to do some work in the University of Texas system. And that was an interesting endeavor. And so, yeah. Anyway, so I won't keep going on, but, you know, it's been interesting. And certainly, you know, covering some CRNA stuff over the years, there's a lot of stuff, despite, you know, a lot of states where the dragnet has now been limited, you know, at least for over a decade or more, where you can't just sue for anything that you want. There are limits. So,
and I think in North Carolina, if my recollection is correct, and it's maybe been 7-8 years ago, the there was a cap that was, I don't know if it would be in regulation or if it was legislated, but there is a cap on damages. Well, that's pretty. That is pretty good. And one of the things that I think that has been a benefit to me professionally doing expert witness work is it's made me a more careful clinician when it comes to documentation and, you know, things that maybe in the past you'd go, I'm not going to write that down.
Yeah.
I am going to write that down. When who did I call? What time did I call? And when did they get there?
So question.
When did the cavalry come? A few minutes ago, when we first started talking, Gary, I mentioned the published standards that have been promulgated by the American Association of Nurse Anesthesiology. So why don't you take a couple minutes and talk a little bit about where CRNAs can find the practice standards, what is included, and particularly the ANA practice, professional practice manual.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Terry. You know, well, fortunately, Terry, you know, the practice manual for CRNAs is easily accessible, you know, on the ANA website at ANA.com. And for those of you CRNAs that are out there listening, And let's hope there's no attorneys out there listening. It's fine if they do. But yeah. I would definitely, definitely encourage every single CRNA, try to get into a habit of logging in and looking at that professional practice manual on an annual basis. When you get to that page on the website, you'll see that there's actually three key sections of the professional practice manual. There's a section on the code of ethics. There's a section on scope of practice, really important one. And then a separate section on specific practice standards. And as we go through a little bit of this, really, really encourage every single CRNA to be cognizant of both of the latter two for sure. Certainly, you know, code of ethics goes without discussion, if you will. So probably a good time to review those standards. And, you know, on the very first page of the standards for the nursing practice section are links to specific situations like anesthesia and analgesia for your obstetric patients, those of you that are doing obstetrics, chronic pain management, you know, and the ever-increasing one now is regional anesthesia and regional anesthesia techniques. And I'd even throw POCUS is probably going to start to emerge in there too. And even a section on the elements of multimodal pain management. You know, the first two standards really deal with patients' rights and, you know, that there's a requirement that every patient have a pre-anesthetic evaluation. So a little note about that. Whether you're doing the pre-anesthetic evaluation or someone else, you certainly need to be cognizant of it. And certainly at a minimum, give it a glance based on, you know, your patient's age, comorbidities, etc. Now, standard three, that does describe what every patient must have is an anesthetic care plan. So whether you're doing a general, whether you're doing a general with a regional, whether you're doing a MAC, you know, those types of things. Standard four describes all of the elements that's required in an informed consent. So you certainly want to make sure that you have that already baked into your informed consents for those of you CRNAs that are actually doing the informed consent. And making sure that you're covered and that you're hitting every one of the bases. You know, a lot of these are preforms, and certainly on the ANA website, there are preformed, informed consents. You just need to make sure that whatever state that you're practicing in, that it certainly checks all those boxes and is compliant with state regulations also. Standard five talks about documentation and the anesthesia record. This is the big bugaboo. As Terry and I have alluded to, you want to document every single piece of anesthetic care, equipment, drug. Not only do you want to document it, you want to make sure that it's legible. I will tell you, trying to decipher some of the Sanskrit in some of these records is really, really challenging. And, you know, when somebody like Terry or I gets called in to defend, heaven forbid ever be on the plaintiff side, we need to be able to decipher what you're writing down and be able to support you. And are you consistent with all of the standards that we're kind of going through right now? The next one is standard six. This is a big one, and it's certainly raising a little awareness and concern for me today. And I'll tell you why in a minute. Standard six describes the equipment and ensuring the proper functioning of that equipment. You know, making sure that all of your equipment is functioning properly is critical. Now, those of you that are out there showing up 10 or 15 minutes before the start of your case or rolling your patient back and not doing proper anesthesia machine checkouts or not being able to troubleshoot your devices. I don't know about you, Terry, but every morning I go in, I am doing at least something at a minimum to my anesthesia machine to make sure that it's compliant. Whether it's a leak, whether it's the O-rings on the vaporizer, whether it's the, you know, the ceramic gaskets that I got to take the unit out and start drying it off, all kinds of things can happen. And heaven forbid you have that happen to you when you now have a patient anesthetized. Standard seven discusses the anesthetic itself, the implementation plan, and the management of the patient. So you want to make sure that you've got plan A, plan B, plan C of how you're going to manage that patient through the induction phase, the maintenance phase, as well as the emergence, as well as recovery. Standard eight actually describes patient positioning. And this is sort of a shared responsibility, right? The entire OR is responsible for this. And I kind of diverge a little bit. Case, I wasn't involved with it, but a colleague of mine, it's about 20 years ago now, big radical mastectomy, bringing up, a VRAM flap. You know, so these cases, typically with microvasculature, take about 12 to 16 hours. Well, CRNA dropped down an NG tube, positioned, everything was fine, surgery went fine, with the exception of not watching the NG tube and the pressure on the end of the nose. Well, the end of the nose got necrotic and had to have several plastic surgeries to do that repair. And that was just, anytime you're looking at your monitors, good habit to get into, and I always do this with students, scan your monitor, scan your machine, scan your drugs it's infusing or whatever it is you're using on your anesthesia workspace, and scan your patient. And that means getting under the drapes, making sure there's no pressure points that are, adverse. And so you want to make sure, like, that's part of our responsibility. It's not infrequent to have a surgeon or a resident or a scrub or anybody on the field that's leaning on the arm boards, they're leaning on the cuff cables or standing on them. So you always want to be watching. Patient positioning, you can't, underscore and highlight enough. Standard 9 talks about monitoring alarms. Oh boy. Specific monitors that are required, right, Terry?
Absolutely, yeah.
Some of those monitors out there, like, you just want to, it's kind of like the little Giphy where the guy picks a computer up off the desk and throws it across the room.
And out the window.
Exactly. Because it does get irritating. But, you want to go into your, and rather than hit silence and ignore the alarms, you want to go in and, are the alarms appropriate for that patient that you're caring for that day? And making sure that you make those adjustments. For example, monitoring oxygen, ventilation, cardiovascular monitors, thermoregulatory temperature. While it's not a standard of care right now, but brainwave activity and looking at brain health, that's another important one that's emerging. And I think as that technology gets a little bit, it's actually come a long way, but it certainly is a good adjunct. And I think as we move through the silver tsunami, we're going to see a lot more patients that are going to need that brain health check, right? So standard 10 now, that talks a little bit about infection control, preventing nosocomial infections. These are the ones that towards the latter part of the professional practice manual that we want to be cognizant of and reading. We go back to the, what year was that, Terry? The Las Vegas case. Reusing syringes and need. I mean, I cringe about it now. Just thinking about picking up and reusing any kind of a syringe, like, you don't even think about it, right? Or at least you shouldn't. Yeah. Those of you that are thinking about it, get out of that habit. Do not be doing that.
And don't share multiple dose vials between patients. Goodness gracious!
Because you have no, like, there is no defense for that, right? I mean, I can't sit up on a witness stand and say, they were in a pinch and maybe they wiped off the outside of the syringe. Like, it's not defensible in the United States, period. So lastly, the final three standards really talk about transferring care to other providers, processes to evaluate quality improvement and patient safety. And so a little note about that is making sure that when you drop off a patient, so, I think as practices get that production pressure of burn and turn, and forgetting to kind of follow up and see how the prior patient was doing and did they meet all the criteria for discharge. And I do see CRNAs getting into trouble in this area and making sure that things are documented appropriately, but also that you've checked on that patient and asked, and that you've documented, I've checked with the PACU nurse, patient is fine, they've met discharge criteria, et cetera. And if there's a concern, whether you escalate it or whether you consult and refer it is the key. Standard 13 addresses the issues of provider wellness. Now, Terry, you and I have talked about informed consent in the past. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit about informed? Because I know It's different in some states, but there is a common guideline that we have to follow under Federal Register, and then take it from there.
Attention all certified nurse anesthetists. Are you in need of a reliable and quality continuing education option? Well, look no further than CRNAeducation.com. We are an NBCRNA recognized provider, offering all four core CPC modules to meet your certification requirements. You can choose from more than 100 AANA prior approved Class A CE credits with 43 articles covering a wide range of anesthesia topics. Need pharmacology CE credits? Well, we've got you covered there as well, with over 40 pharmacology CE credits available. All credits are completed online and are mobile friendly. Choose articles worth 1, 2, or 3 credits. There's no subscriptions, no hidden fees, just the CE credits you need when you need them. Owned by CRNAs since 2011, you can trust in our commitment to your education. And customer service is always a quick email or phone call or even text away. To sign up and find out more about our education options, visit CRNAeducation.com, your partner in continuing education. That's CRNAeducation.com.
On one level, you know, talking about informed consent can be a little bit cumbersome, but you know, there are some just common sense elements that really do constitute what is informed consent. And it's really all about a conversation between the anesthesia provider and the patient and the disclosure of information and establishing expectations. So what you do have to do is share with the patient the information that allows them to make an informed decision about their own care and make choices based on their own judgments. So you want to be able to explain to them the risks and benefits and the potential downsides and alternatives to the anesthesia care plan, whether it's a general anesthetic that could easily be done under a regional anesthetic or maybe even done under a deep sedation with local anesthesia. And I often get questions about, you know, what risks am I obligated to disclose to the patient? And again, the discussion of risks doesn't have to include every possible risk or complication. Like, well, you know, there's a 1 in 4 million chance that you could fall off the bed. Well, you don't have to do that. Yeah. But you want to talk about the things that are most common and maybe even mention those that are most serious. So, you know, have a discussion to a patient that's going to have general anesthesia about the possibility of having a little bit of a sore throat or maybe even have some postoperative nausea and vomiting or experiencing discomfort postoperatively and assure them that those things will be taken care of if they occur. Now, I know in the past, I've had some questions asked to me, and it's pretty interesting. The most frequent one that I've heard is, you know, am I going to be asleep for the whole procedure?
You know? Oh, yeah.
No.
We wake you up.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, in the case of maybe there will be intraoperative wake up if you're having Harrington Rod back in the bad old days. But that's not the case anymore. And of course, the other one is, am I going to be asleep during the whole procedure? And parenthetically, am I going to wake up at the end? So yeah, that is the plan. I guess probably been 10 or 15 years ago, there was a film that was released called Awake.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Talked about a patient having open heart surgery and being conscious during the periods of his surgery. You know, now, fortunately, as we're all aware, awareness under anesthesia is pretty uncommon, and there are ways to prevent it. So I couch that discussion, if it should come up, to share that there are certain high-risk patients, folks that are just sick as a dickens or maybe badly injured, that there's an increased risk. But generally, the risk of awareness under anesthesia is pretty darn remote. And, you know, we've got some pretty strong recommendations about ways to prevent that from happening. You know, occasionally patients may ask me, you know, am I going to survive this thing? Which is, you know, I think a reasonable question to ask, particularly in the lay community. And it's interesting. I just read an article this weekend about the use of capnometry and capnography in high-income cultures and in low-income nations. And one of the things that they talked about was that, oh gosh, in the dark ages before pulse oximetry and capnography, the incidence of anesthesia mishaps resulting in patient harm and death was about one in every 1,500.
Wow.
And now it's like one in 100,000 in high-income patients. So that means two things. It means you're probably going to go through your entire career and not have a patient death related to an anesthesia misadventure. So patients are really pretty reassured by that. So again, care today is really good. We've got better monitors, we've got better drugs, we have a better understanding of pathophysiology, and all those things contribute to patient safety and give us the ability to, you know, detect and manage problems much, much earlier before things get out of hand. And one of the things that I do share with patients, all the things that we're going to do to monitor them, you know, EKG, pulse oximetry, end-tidal CO2, real-time ST segment trending, and all of those things. That's even, you know, and I know not everybody is a devotee of using a BIS monitor, but there are ways that we can confidently reassure folks that they're going to be asleep even if they don't use a BIS monitor. So that's pretty good. That's generally reassures patients. Now, there is one population that sometimes gets scrutinized, and it's worth mentioning, and that's the obstetric patient who's having a labor epidural and who is uncomfortable and anxious when you meet them. And I think the general consensus of the anesthesia community is those patients are capable of providing informed consent. And the process of providing informed consent does not have to take more than, you know, 30 or 40 seconds with that patient.
Yeah.
You know, here's the benefits of a labor epidural. Here's the potential complications. Here's what you expect to happen. Here's what we think we can manage if we do have a complication. So that's pretty good. And when I began my anesthesia career, how long has it been? It's been almost, goodness gracious, almost 40 years. Anyway, our understanding of informed consent is involved. So I would encourage our listeners to go to the ANA website and look at the document that describes all the detail and all the elements of informed consent. It's 22-page PDF.
Yeah,
It's you know,
quick
it's
read.
Far beyond the scope of this conversation, but it's worth a good look. And again, you and I, Gary, we've had conversations about monitoring, and you mentioned alarms during anesthesia care. So take just a minute or two and share with our listeners some of the things that are in the standards specifically about monitoring and alarms.
Absolutely, Terry. You know, Standard 9 addresses monitoring and alarms, and there's five key areas that are discussed there to safeguard patient safety. And those are oxygenation, ventilation, cardiovascular monitoring, temperature monitoring, and neuromuscular blocker monitoring. And that's a big one, because I think, you know, with the onset now of Sugammadex, you know, there is the ability to get a little bit lackadaisical, right? Is to just, oh, I can just reverse it with Sugammadex. And you never want somebody 0 out of 4 twitches. Obviously, once you've given muscle relaxant, you're going to hit that 0, but, you know, maintaining 2 out of 4. And I just want to take that as an aside. And so, you know, we've talked about some of these new standards and recommendations for neuromuscular blocking monitoring previously on previous episodes, you know, but two of the most important are the two standards that address oxygenation and ventilation monitoring specifically. Now, these standards recommend continuous monitoring of oxygenation by clinical observation, and that means looking at the patient to make sure that they're breathing and ventilating. Heaven forbid we put our eyes on the patient. What?
I've got shopping to do.
Yes, you know. Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
My goodness gracious.
Well, I got to look at their...
watching an episode of Bones.
They will be phone. if you don't monitor your patient, they'll be boned for sure. You know, how dare I look at their lips and their gums, etc. You know, oxygenation by clinical observation, and that means literally looking at the patient to make sure, as I said, that they're breathing and ventilating, and monitoring oxygenation by pulse oximetry. Now, the ventilation monitoring standards specifically require end-tidal CO2 monitoring, even in moderate or deep sedation, as well as general anesthesia. And that, in addition to the observation of chest excursion and confirmation of expired carbon dioxide, it's really important to emphasize the value of carbon dioxide monitoring because it's an early sign of all kinds of things, interruption of ventilation, malignant hyperthermia, you know, whereas pulse oximetry is typically a latter sign because of that delay, right? The shape of the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve, all kinds of things that need to be I had a student the other day, and we were going through some of this stuff, the oxygen hemoglobin dissociation curve and age and things like COPD and heart failure. And I had to chuckle because I had a medical student kind of say the same thing to me years ago as I'm kind of doing the preceptor pimping and
one of my favorite sports.
Yeah, exactly. And the student says, you know, now that you talk about all, I remember learning that in class, and now it makes sense. And I'm like, you should be applying this every day. Anyway,
it should have made sense before now.
Well, I give them credit. They're junior. They're just into clinicals now. So, but you know, when ventilation is interrupted or stopped, particularly when the fraction of inspired oxygen is high, hemoglobin saturation may be sustained for a deceptively long period of time before it actually falls when you have that interrupted ventilation. And one of the perfect examples, you know, I had a difficult airway last week, and, you know, patients got trismus, they can bear this small oral aperture, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is not going to be a standard, tumors in the back of their jaw, in the back of their neck. And so I use a ProView, so basically, you know, like the video laryngoscopies. And I get a beautiful view, but it was pretty tight going in with the blade. And but prior to doing any of that stuff, as we're putting monitors on and getting the patient ready, we're having that patient breathe 100% oxygen. I let the nurses know that are circulating. I said, hey, look, potentially difficult airway. I'm going to need all hands on deck when we're putting on monitors. I want to make sure she's going to get good oxygenation. And I said, I'm going to need everybody, if I need someone to hand ventilate on the bag, et cetera. Interesting. So we go in, get a grade one view, but even with a styleted endotracheal tube, it would not hook up to get through the cords. While I'm looking at the cords, wide open. And I'm like, gah. So I tell the doc I said, go get me the bougie. Let's just make it real slick. Easy, easy, right? Yeah. And I said, I don't know
famous last words.
Exactly. Right. Well, I said, I don't know if you played hockey before, but I said, I need a good hook on this one. So I put the bougie in, and as I'm twisting it in my fingers, I cannot, even with the angle upside down, I cannot hook into the arytenoids. And I'm like, oh boy. I said, well, the good thing is we can ventilate. So no panic. Let me pull the bougie out, go get the fiber optic, and let's put the fiber optic down the channel of the ProView of the video laryngoscope, and then hook in the fiber optic that way. So it was kind of a two-person job. I can see a little bit of nervousness, and I said, guys, we're 100%. Just relax. If we have to come out, we can come out, and we can hand ventilate and then make decisions then. So anyway, I said, let me go ahead. I'll ventilate a little bit more. So we ventilate. Patient never came down below 100% till we got the fiber optic set up. I go back in with the ProView, go in with the fiber optic, and we couldn't get the fiber optic in. Two or three tries.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So I'm thinking, we can't abort this case. So I said, give me a really good hook on the stylet and put it back into the tube. We stylet the tube, good hook. Managed to just drop just at the back of the cords. And I said, slowly pull that stylet out, kind of thread it in. And now the tube seemingly was too big, wouldn't go through the cords, but I'm sitting right on top of the arytenoids. So I said, take the bougie, let's go through the tube. So we take the bougie, go through the tube, get it into the airway, pull the tube out, hold on to the bougie. I said, let's go down to a 6.5. Well, the 6.5 doesn't fit through the bougie. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
when are we going to stabilize this airway? So anyway, I said, all right, give me the 7. And so we had to basically corkscrew it in, but we got it in. And then we went down with the fiber optic and the two circulators is like, this is the smoothest, difficult airway that the saturation never dropped below 100. I said, so guys, this is a learning opportunity, right? Is we ventilated, we had some trouble, nobody panicked, and we kept 100%, and we can back out and we can wake this patient up because we can ventilate her effectively as needed. And so, you know, and everybody's like, man, that was really cool. That was really, it's like, well, they don't all go that way. But but nonetheless, it was just a, you know, sort of a reminder, never, we are the experts in this field, right? Of managing airway and ventilation. And so it behooves us to make sure that we keep our, so point being on the deceptively long period of saturation, knowing that, you know, the blood is quickly accumulating carbon dioxide with metabolism and stuff. So somehow that has to get out, and that's usually by the lungs. So,
yeah, I think that's the only way it gets out.
That's
in,
it. That's
in the
right.
Short term.
That's right. Anyways, you know, finally, yeah. You know, this applies to all the physiologic monitors. You know, the monitors, if they have variable pitch, they should be audible. Don't be silencing those things unless it's, you know, for that brief, whatever it is, 60 or 120 seconds. But they should never, ever, ever be turned off. Always adjust your monitors, your alarms to the patient's needs specifically.
Yeah. You know, and it's tempting. You know, there's lots of conversations that have occurred talking about, you know, alarm fatigue.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I think, you know, one of the things, like you mentioned, if the alarm has a variable pitch, I mean, adjust the volume
yes.
so that it gets your attention, but doesn't,
yeah,
doesn't
drive you nuts.
You put a gun to your head. Anyway,
absolutely.
Yeah, you're right. You can, you know, silence them briefly. You know, one of the places that you might see that happen is if you're, you know, going to do an induction on a gurney and turning a patient prone.
Right. Yeah.
You're going to take those monitors off for just a second and throw them back on just right away. So, but you're right. You should never turn the darn things off. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, some of the most challenging cases that I've been asked to defend are those cases where the patient's injuries occurred when, you know, the clearly articulated and published AANA standards were not followed.
Yeah.
And you know, specifically, I have evaluated cases where the alarms were turned off and there was an interruption in ventilation that was not detected in a timely fashion, and there was a patient injury. And in that case, you really don't have a leg to stand on.
Yeah.
You know, there's some other common problems that I've seen, and Gary, I'm sure you have as well. But the most common problems that I've seen come across my desk that resulted in litigation or the filing of a complaint fall into 4 main categories.
Yeah.
The first being an incomplete or inadequate evaluation.
Yep.
Didn't do a good airway evaluation. Didn't find out when the patient last ate or drank. You know, that Domino's pizza and the patient taking Ozempic can be
comes
in there
up
for
fast.
A while. Yep. And it might, you know, maybe they didn't stop their Ozempic or Wegovy 7 days
well,
ago.
Well, like you know, and Terry, I think you bring up a good point, and I think it warrants highlighting it again. And as if those of you listening don't know, go back to our Ozempic and our GPL receptor agonist.
Our inaugural
that's right.
broadcast.
That's exactly right. And review that because this is going to be more and more common. And having, you know, so I actually had, speak of the devil, 2 weeks ago, patient on Ozempic was not off it for the recommended time period. We still decided to go do it. And it was a big belly case. So I went ahead and I put down the NG tube. 700 cc's came back.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff. So don't underestimate. So to your point, absolutely.
Yeah. And again, I think we're going to see that more and more and more as that drug becomes, that class of drugs becomes more and more available. And again, another ones we alluded to a little bit earlier is not following the monitoring standards.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and we know we love to have a little bit of good, good music in the operating room. And, but we have to be really careful that we don't lose track of the most important thing that goes on in the room, and that is taking care of the patient. And I remember when I was a student, I walked into the classroom at the Academy of Health Sciences down at Fort Sam Houston, Texas, and there was a banner across the top of the classroom that said, "Vigilance is the price of safety."
Okay.
And and that was pounded into me from day one. That and then it was not, I was not capable or responsible for making the coffee. I mean, that's another story. Anyway, another thing that I've seen that has gotten folks into trouble is when you lose track of blood loss and fluid status, and patients get hypovolemic and hypotensive. And that can really cause a lot of problems. And as you said earlier, we talked about hypovolemia and hypoxemia, and we just have to be very, very vigilant. And you mentioned what we learned in anesthesia was like a 5-second sweep, where you went from the machine to the monitors to the field, and then back, a couple of times every single minute, just to always be on top of what's going on, staying vigilant. There's no harm in looking over the drape into the field.
That's
what's going on.
And I try to impress that upon the students too, is always be watching the surgeon's hands. Cause I'll tell you, when things go to hell in the handbasket, they know what you're doing, right? They know whether you're paying attention or not. I just want to make a comment about fluids and hypovolemia and whatnot. A simple thing to do on your monitor. Every single one of us have this capability. You don't need all the fancy A-lines. And this has been proven in the ICU back in the 1980s. Lots of research. Change the sweep speed on your pulse oximeter to 6.25 millimeters per second. And you will get a trending of the pulsus paradoxus when you're hypovolemic. Easy thing to do. Give a little bit of fluid. If they start to come up and that starts to abate, you know that you've managed that sort of that loss. But to your point, Terry, I think looking over that drape at all given times, because, once you hear the suction noise, sometimes it's too late.
Yeah. When you hear the...
Exactly.
That should make the hair back of your neck stand up.
when it's audible is at the end of suctioning the 1 or 2 liters out of the cavity.
that's exactly right. Wow. And in the past, I've looked at a couple of cases too that resulted in litigation as a result of nerve injuries related to positioning and direct pressure on nerves, stretching nerves. Yep. A couple positions that are particularly problematic are the lateral decubitus position for brachial plexus injuries, and the prone position with the neurosurgeons love that Superman position.
Yep.
You really got to watch those brachial plexus and the ulnar nerve. So
even the other ones now, because everybody wants to do robots, right? And the extreme Trendelenburg position. So patients rolling off the table, or to your point, getting brachial plexus injuries because of the stretch on the shoulders, because of all these devices that are coming out there to try to optimally position the patient when the surgeon wants them essentially in a gravity boots is sort of the position they want. It's like, that's not possible, sir or ma'am.
And that reminds me, we're going to have to, let's be sure to do a podcast on optimal ventilation strategies here quick down the road, because that robotic surgery brings that right to mind. You've got a patient with a big pneumoperitoneum, they're tipped upside down, who knows how long, and those that driving pressure can get pretty high.
Yes.
But anyway, so those are all the things that can just some of the examples of things that can get us in trouble and result in a filed complaint. But before we get much further down the road, and we've talked about a little bit about negligence and that. So Gary, take a minute and talk to us a little bit about what elements that have to be established or demonstrated in order to say that negligence has occurred.
Beyond the Mask is made possible by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. With almost 2 decades of experience, the firm guides CRNAs through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Schedule a free consultation today by calling 855-304-3748 or go online to crnafinancialplanning.com.
Yeah, you're so right, Terry. You know, these elements have to be established, or that have to be established, include things like the existence of a duty to care, a breach of that duty to care, and of course, you know, the existence of patient injury, or being able to make the direct connection between the breach of the standard of care that can be shown to be an approximate cause of that specific injury to the patient. Now, you know, there's some subtle nuances to those factors. You know, we might ask, you know, what is the duty of care? Well, you know, the duty of care requires anesthesia providers like CRNAs, nurse anesthetists, conduct themselves in a way that's reasonably prudent, or any careful person would conduct themselves in a similar circumstance. And so, you know, anesthesia care does not have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be the very best possible care, but only what a reasonable and careful ordinary clinician would choose to do under similar circumstance. And so now, you know, in some jurisdictions, there are some subtle variations in how local, state, national standards interpret this. But, you know, in general, when providers follow published professional standards, the standards of care can actually be shown to be acceptable. Other elements, for example, that exist of an injury are usually self-evident, and, you know, connecting those dots between the injury and the cause, or at least correlation, also tend to be fairly straightforward, although that's not always the case, you know. So this leads us back to the question, who evaluates whether or not the standard of care has been satisfied? And Terry, who makes the judgment on whether or not care has been met by the standard?
Yeah, that's where it gets a little bit interesting, and that's where folks like Gary and Terry come in, who act as expert witnesses. And the expert witness is really the one who offers the testimony to determine or provide an opinion about whether the standard of care had been met. And now, just any anesthesia provider off the street can walk in and render an opinion. That expert has to be qualified. And when I say qualified, it's not a state of being, rather, but do they meet certain thresholds to be called qualified? So they have to have similar professional background, similar education, similar practice. They should have been in the past 2 or 3 years involved in similar kinds of cases, so they can say, well, this is something that I do in my practice, and this is what a reasonable or a careful provider would do under those similar circumstances. And it's really important to, and in both plaintiffs and defendant and providers, attorneys will do this long before you get to deposition, because it's pretty embarrassing to get to trial and have an expert disqualified. So they'll, you know, that expert will be qualified long before they ever get to raising their hand and offering expert testimony.
You know, Terry, let me kind of interject there a little bit. So there is a new law in Texas over the last year or two that's come into place, and now an expert witness must be deemed as a peer. So what does that mean? So for example, you cannot have a physician anesthesiologist as an expert witness over a nurse anesthetist's care. It must be a CRNA or nurse anesthetist. So just be mindful of your state rules and regs too, should you ever find yourself in this predicament as to who can be your expert witness or on the plaintiff's side.
Yeah, and that's going to vary, like you said, from state to state and from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
And all the attorneys will know, you know, what those stipulations are.
Yep.
So, you know, whether the attorney is advocating for the patient or the clinician, there's a couple of things they want the expert to be. They want them to have a strong education, training background, similar clinical experiences, And, you know, as Gary alluded to a little bit earlier, a trial is really a little bit of theory of theater, right? And so it's important for the expert to be well-spoken, to be articulate, to be calm, and not to lose their cool. And so, again, that's the same for whether the attorney wants to have an expert advocating on behalf of the provider or the patient. So, you know, Gary, you've done a lot of case reviews. So share with our listeners a little bit about some of the things an expert needs to think about and consider after they've reviewed a case and are getting ready to share their opinions about the care with the attorneys have reached out to them.
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. You know, the expert doesn't have to memorize the medical record by any stretch of the imagination, you know, but the expert should read everything sent to them very thoroughly. And that can be quite a process sometimes when you've got documents that are 1,400 to 2,000 pages of paperwork. It's a fair amount, you know.
Yeah, but they take it off the truck with with a forklift on a pallet.
Yeah. Back in the days when we didn't have thumb drives, I remember them showing up on the doorstep with, you know, five boxes of medical records. It's like, oh boy, I have to take a little bit of PTO here. But, you know, in addition to that, you know, if there's other sources of information, records, depositions, transcripts, for example, the expert would find valuable information in formulating their opinion, you know, and they should ask the attorney for them. Once the expert, and typically, you know, when you're in a case like that, they're pretty good to kind of every single piece of document that comes out, they're pretty good to get into your hands ASAP. But, and I would say that, you know, if you're on the defense side, that even as if you're being sued, is that it's good to know that information yourself, particularly if you haven't been deposed yet, so that you kind of know where things are going. You know, once the expert has developed their opinion about the care and the quality of care that was provided and whether it met standard, they should be very clear and firm in those opinions. And so the expert should be willing to be able to discuss those openly and candidly with the attorneys, because the attorney does want your honest opinion. Most attorneys have already read the chart thoroughly, and they got some pretty good insight, and they're already trying to connect the dots. And so basically what you're doing is, from an expert side, is validating those connections and coming up with some of your professional expertise, as we've said, as any reasonable clinician would do in the same circumstances. And, you know, and they know where the challenges and the problems are in the case. They can help you navigate as an expert, but they really want your honest, candid, defensible opinion. And if your honest opinion really differs from what's required to advocate for their client, they will likely choose, in some cases, not to use you as an expert, or they may decide to settle quickly. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, made those recommendations, is like, you know, this is a tough case. If you take the 30,000 foot view, can you navigate a conversation? Because when you sit down in deposition, the plaintiff attorney is going to push your buttons. And I think Terry alluded to the fact that you need to not only be, you know, versant and being able to discuss the matters, but you also need to make sure that emotions don't, and you don't allow the plaintiff side to get at you. And they can be quite caustic. And you just cannot allow yourself to get rattled. You know, as the expert witness, you're the expert. They don't know. And I have many times said, I respectfully disagree. The answer is no. You know, and with all that being said, you know, towards the end of the conversation, you know, you say, thank you very much for your time. You know, they'll let you know that we'll be in contact if there's more information that you require. And then please send me an invoice, you know. And Terry, you know, what are some of the things the provider should do if there has been a patient injury or they are concerned about a complaint being filed against them?
You know, that's a good question. This is probably a good place to talk about that. You know, anyone who's been in practice for any amount of time has been in situations where we've been concerned about a patient's outcome. It's been a difficult case. Maybe there's been a lot of blood loss. Maybe the patient was, a victim of trauma, and they've come to the OR, and it's been a hard time getting him through the case. But, you know, we usually are aware of those things. But sometimes the first notice that we have that there's been a complaint filed is when the attorney's office delivers a request for patient records to the medical records department at the hospital or the organization. And that should be a big red flag. But anyway, if there's been an injury or concern, there are several things that a provider should do right away if they think they're going to be the target of a legal complaint. First of all, and first and foremost, if there's been a bad outcome, you know, you should notify your carrier or the hospital's carrier immediately so they can have a heads up. Now, almost every organization, hospital of any size is going to have an insurance carrier, and they're going to have a law firm on retainer that they can reach out to right away and give them a heads up. But there may be times, for example, if you are you know, a 1099 employee, you're carrying your own malpractice insurance, you know, you may, you know, want to have a, you know, a relationship with an attorney to begin with so that you can have them to call on if there should be a bad outcome. A couple of things to just kind of keep in the back of your mind, and Gary alluded to a little bit about charting earlier. It's okay if in real time, if there's a charting error, or, you know, for example, in time or whatever, to make that correction on the chart or the notation at what time the correction is made. But it's probably not a good idea to go back in the electronic medical record the next day and make changes, you know, which is sometimes, you know, we lose track of the fact that every time you engage an electronic medical record, the person who accessed the record, the time, the date, everything's time-stamped. So it looks really bad if there is two copies of the medical record that winds up being admitted as evidence, and they are different, and there's a paper trail, if you will, electronic paper trail of when those changes were made in the record, and you know that does not look good. You know, another thing that's really difficult for providers to wrap their heads around, if they know in real time that there's been a bad outcome, we should not discuss that case with others of the care team who might also be eventually named in the complaint. You know, hallway conversations, bad idea. Around the coffee pot, you know, what happened? What do you think happened? You know, what was wrong? There is a safe place to have those discussions, and that's in a quality assurance meeting. As a general rule, the government wants providers to engage in quality assurance, evaluation of care. And so almost always those conversations under that umbrella are going to be deemed not discoverable. But if you're having a conversation on the telephone with the surgeon or the anesthesiologist the next day or the scrub or the circulator, one of the things that could be asserted is that you all got together and cooked up a story. And you don't ever want that to be a question. So again, those conversations really do need to take place in the quality assurance umbrella. So, you know, what are some other things, Gary, that a clinician can do if they have to testify on their own behalf to get ready and be a good advocate for themselves at deposition or at trial?
Well, Terry, you know, that's where the anxiety starts, right? Before we even talk about how to behave, let's talk a little bit more about the difference between a deposition and trial testimony. You know, in both cases, testimony during a deposition and during a trial are sworn testimonies. You're held to a pretty high standard in terms of candor and honesty. So now a deposition is a little bit less formal than a trial, but in either case, you know, testimony will be recorded by a court recorder, who is usually in the physical presence of the witness. And so the purpose of a deposition is really to establish the facts and the opinions about the facts that occurred, while the purpose of a trial testimony is to persuade and educate the jury about these events and whether the standard of care was met or breached. Normally, a trial will be held in the presence of a jury. But there is a kind of a trial in some jurisdictions called a bench trial. And this is where the judge is present with written documentation and testimony about the complaint. And the judge will independently decide as to whether or not the findings will be in favor of the provider or the patient. Now, before we get too much further, you know, I want to reemphasize that anxiety or amygdala hijack can really take on, right, during a deposition or in trial. And you know, the deposition is really where the plaintiff attorney is going to put on some gloves, and they're going to hit you as hard as they can, and they're going to try to knock you off your game. Again, it's all about fact-finding, and certainly your defense attorney is pretty good at, you know, identifying things like speculation. And I bring that up is because what the plaintiff will try to do is that, well, you know, wouldn't this be the next rational step? And you'll start going down that pathway, and the defense attorney will actually intervene and say, that's just speculation. You know, rephrase the question, if you will. And so you got to be careful with that. There are some nuances, and good attorneys will prep you for some of this stuff and when they're going to intervene. So, but again, if you're not nervous in a deposition or a trial, there's something wrong with you. You are not going to do well.
Attention. Yeah. And so you have to be prepared when you're getting ready to give a deposition or testify or trial, whether you're defending yourself and the care that you provided, or whether or not you're offering an opinion in someone else's standard of care. And so I want to remind our listeners of a subtle point that sometimes gets overlooked, and that is what is and what is not discoverable. And discoverable simply means whether or not it can be introduced in trial as evidence. And so that covers a lot of ground. That can include notes that you've made for yourself, the entirety of emails that you've exchanged with with attorneys, your own telephone records, and particularly, as we said, pay attention to the OR. If you're surfing the internet phone, you know, that's discoverable. Invoices that you filed, prior testimony, your work history, all that is expert. So you really have to be careful about what you write, say, in email, and say to attorneys, because it can all come out in a public forum. So there you go. Right,
well, here. Terry, if you think back, there was a case in Dallas, Texas. This is probably going on 10 years ago now. Anesthesia, physician anesthesiologist in the operating room during Christmas. And he was surfing social media, making comments about how much it sucked to be on call and how he's got to do this damn, you know, going on and on and on. And patient had a cardiac event intraoperatively, goes to court, goes to trial. In the deposition, so difference between deposition and trial. In the deposition, the plaintiff attorney got the anesthesiologist, the physician, to say, no, I don't surf social media when I'm in the operating room. Okay, fine. It's now on record, and he's taken oath that those are true and factual to the best of his knowledge. They now go to trial. They pulled all of his social media records. They go to trial, put him up on the witness stand. They ask him to read the script from the social media exchanges. And then they bring up the deposition as to what. And so it was indefensible, right? Wow. I mean, case closed. So those of you that are surfing the internet and on social media while you're in the operating room, big no-no. And just be forewarned. Certainly, if this podcast doesn't serve as a forewarning, perhaps the deposition will.
And nothing, despite what you might believe, nothing is ever deleted.
Absolutely. You know, Terry, you know, there's some really simple common sense rules to remember, you know, when giving things like testimony. So whether you're testifying as an expert or you're on your own defense, the first rule is always, always be prepared. You need to know that medical record. Again, it doesn't need to be committed to memory, but when you're being tested on that in whether it's trial or whether it's deposition, you need to be able to speak to the facts. Right. And so, again, warning everybody or, you know, certainly encouraging you to go to the ANA website, pull that document down and read those documents and making sure that you're actually adhering to that on a day-to-day practice. Now, the attorney who's working with you should prepare you and help you anticipate the sort of questions that you're going to be asked by the plaintiff attorney. You know, and it's not foolproof. I mean, but is a good first step. One of the things that I've learned over the years is it's the best argument. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're right or wrong. The better argument typically is the one that wins, you know? So an attorney, you know, once told me that a deposition's not a conversation. You should be succinct and answer the questions yes or no, if that's the correct answer, or short answer, if it's appropriate. Do not go in and start having this soliloquy of and diatribes of explanation. Very short, succinct, so that it parallels the standards of care. And it's important, again, not to elaborate, you know, unnecessarily, because that'll lead down, you know, the paths of places where you just don't want to open up Pandora's box, because you'll never get that lid shut. Because the minute the plaintiff attorney identifies that, they're going to put the screws into you as hard as they possibly can. And they're going to get very belligerent. And typically, the defense attorney is good to kind of shut it down a little bit, but it doesn't stop them. I mean, they'll throw things across the room. They'll slam the desk. I mean, I've seen all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's actually, if you don't let it rattle you, it's kind of entertaining. Because if you can actually maintain your composure and just answer yes, no, and keep it limited, it shuts them down. And so, you know, they'll make some explicitives, and that's fine. Not a problem.
Yeah.
If you don't know the answer to the question, just simply say, I don't know, I don't recall. You know, another thing that's important is to keep up with your science. And I know this sometimes sounds like a broken record, which Terry and I tend to try and reinforce on every single podcast, but knowing how the monitors that you use work, knowing the physiology and pharmacology of all the drugs that you're administering or a given in care of patients in is really critically important. You know, it looks bad to the jury, whether you're an expert or a caregiver, and you're asked about the tools that you use on a daily basis, and you can't answer that question. You live and breathe that information. You should always be able to answer the questions about medications, physiology, monitors clearly, concisely, and with confidence. And of course, you should never lie. You should never fabricate to support your testimony. You know, I had a law firm that, you know, the case, this was quite some time ago, and just to kind of give you an idea of how well, you know, I think it was an endoscopy case, and, you know, and the team executed their resuscitation after they recognized, you know, failed airway immediately. They intubated, they did ACLS protocol, they stabilized, they moved out to an acute care facility. Everything was done correctly, you know, and so I knew all the little wee nuances. And so one of the things I love reading is the expert plaintiff witnesses' depositions and their expert opinion, because you can glean a lot of opportunity through that. And so I typically try to live and breathe that sort of information so that when I have the conversations with, you know, the plaintiff or the defense attorney, that I can give them some additional advice on next time you talk or when you go into deposition with their expert witness, ask this question. It will lead them in this direction if they're not knowledgeable, and then you can follow up with this question. And so I do a lot of that with attorneys, and they're like, well, and I've actually had them call and say, you just closed the case because we made them look so stupid in deposition that once we showed the actual information, like, for example, you know, American Heart Association and going through ACLS protocol. Soon as they got them to read the ACLS protocol, it's like, well, do you, when was the last time you got certified? Oh, well, 3 years ago. Well, isn't it every 2 years? And then they take them down that pathway and they totally negate the value of that expert witness on the plaintiff side. So anyway.
Well, you know, and that brings us to a pretty good point. As a general rule, and I've worked with, like I said, I've worked with attorneys for, you know, 30 years or more. And you know, as a general rule, these are really bright, hardworking people. I've never met a stupid attorney.
No,
I really haven't.
No,
you know, they are always on their toes in terms of being prepared. Now, you know, I have, as Gary said, I've had attorneys who sort of transitioned their approach to me between deposition and trial. I've had them be super nice to me at deposition and kind of get aggressive at trial. And I've had them be just a little bit, you know, edgy with me at deposition and then be very saccharine and sweet at trial. And what they're doing there is they're getting you off your equilibrium. And one of the things that I had happened to me recently was I was testifying at trial, and the defense counsel for whom I was working went through a long history about, you know, my time in the military and things that I had done professionally. And the first thing the plaintiff's attorney said to me when she stood up was, "Oh, thank you, Dr. Wicks, for your service to our country." And all of a sudden I got this warm, fuzzy feeling. And for just a minute, my defenses went down. And that's a risk you don't want to take. Now, as Gary said, sometimes the attorneys are going to get a little bit aggressive with you. Oftentimes, your attorney is going to express an objection, or the judge is going to, you know, get that reined in. But again, it's always important to, you know, sustain your calm and maintain good communication skills and have that strong positive a professional presence. Again, they know the law, absolutely, but you know your practice and your profession. So that, just stay calm. Don't be arrogant. Don't be condescending, because the judge is not going to take a very good view. And again, you may be asked to address the jury on a specific issue, but that's not the time to be freelancing and talking to the jury, because the judge is going to be real upset with you, if you exceed the boundaries of good behavior in the courtroom. And again, just even though the situation may be anxiety provoking for you, the atmosphere requires that you be civil and polite. And that's your best behavior. So again, you know, one of the things, now I mentioned going to trial, Gary, how often, you know, do these things go to trial? What's your experience?
Yeah, Terry, that's a good question. You know, most of the time, following the filing of a complaint and after the discovery and depositions have taken place, you know, there'll be a concerted effort to really settle the case. You know, most of the time, these cases don't go to trial. There's several good reasons for that. Number one, trials are extremely expensive and extremely time consuming, because they do try to do a good job when it does go to trial to make sure that everybody's schedules are accommodated, and it's not infrequent for them to be delayed and delayed and delayed, you know. And you know, when attorneys are at trial, he or she is unable to do other work while the trial's going on. So it's extremely time consuming, even for the attorneys themselves. Now, the plaintiff's attorney doesn't really want to go to trial if they can avoid it. You know, they'd rather settle also. And the reason is very straightforward. You know, if they go to trial and a defense finding is the result of the trial, they won't get paid. And so it's just not worth their effort. The defense counsel would prefer to settle without going to trial most of the time. Because they're trying to save the insurance company as well as the defendant as much money as possible. So they know they're better off to settle outside of trial, and, you know, for known amount, whatever that is, they can go to trial and have the jury decide on how much the plaintiff is going to receive as a result of the verdict at the trial. You know, and lastly, courts doesn't really want you to go to trial because, again, it's all time consuming, and, you know, they have other important cases to try rather than litigating on healthcare things. And it's, you know, that starts to pull on emotional strings and whatnot. So, you know, in aggregate, the defense counsel, the patient's counsel or plaintiff counsel, and the court really prefer seeing settling of the cases in mediation, truly, rather than going to trial.
Yeah, and you know, one of the cases that I was involved in most recently, even in mediation, resulted in an award of $13 million for the patient.
Really?
Yeah, a lot. So, yeah, it was a big dollar settlement. But that attorney and I both went to undergraduate school at the University of Iowa and lived in the same Animal House dormitory the first year. But anyway, this attorney that I worked with was really very, very thorough. And it was a bad case. They needed to settle because I think if they'd gone to trial, it would have been even worse.
Yeah.
Well, Gary, we've covered a ton of ground today, you know.
Have we?
We've talked about knowing and following anesthesia standards is so, so important. Yeah. We've talked about ways to stay out of trouble. Yeah. You know, maybe the best way to stay out of trouble is to treat your patients like you would a member of your own family. Absolutely. I want somebody in your family you like, now, mind
yeah,
you.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked about things to do and not to do when bad things happen. We reviewed giving testimony at deposition and at trial. And what to do if you think you might be a defendant in civil litigation involving a bad patient outcome. And finally, I think it's important to remember when there's a bad outcome or a patient injury that results in death or permanent disability, it's a tragedy for everyone concerned. It's a tragedy for the family, for the patient. And, you know, we've talked about second provider.
Yeah.
Or second victim, and it's a devastating experience for the providers as well. So it's always good to go back and listen to those second victim podcasts. You know, we worked hard on those.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Anyway, so be mindful as a provider and as expert that you're the one person involved who's primarily committed to justice and the truth, because you're working on behalf of the profession. All right, Gary, wrap this thing up and get us out of here. Thank you, loyal listeners, for being with us on another Anesthesia Alchemy. Gary and Terry, literally unplugged right here. Take us on out
absolutely,
of here, Gary.
Terry. You know, we want to thank everybody again for joining this podcast today. Hopefully this is giving you a few little nuggets for your career, especially if you're just entering into the career of nurse anesthesia. Never be concerned to reach out to either Terry or I too, you know, for any advice. And, you know, as Terry alluded to, making sure that you're not on your devices in the operating room, making sure that you are the expert in accordance to the standard of care, and that you are documenting those elements that are outlined in the AANA professional practice documents, really, really important. And the other piece, I think if you ever are on the defense as a defendant, that you make sure that, and Terry's brought this up, I think I brought it up a couple of times, that not only are you expert in what you do as far as your care rendered, that it's consistent with the chart, like any, you know, this is the thing, is that any prudent anesthesia provider would do under the same circumstances. Doesn't have to be perfect. There are bad outcomes, but it's how you intervene with some of those bad outcomes. We're not going to save everybody. It's not going to be 100%. Patients do die under anesthesia. It's not common, thank God, as we've seen the stats. Or they come close to dying, and we pull them out of the drain, right? And stabilize them to care and whatnot. And so if you're defending that type of event, to make sure that you're dressed professionally when you are visible, whether that's in trial or whether that's in deposition, that you are polite and making sure that you're just speaking to the facts. Don't be rambling on, and your nerves are going to be just racing, raging epinephrine going through your veins. And so you want to make sure you keep that under control. And certainly, you know, your defense attorneys will do a good job of prepping you and making sure that they're going to give you the cues to make sure that you intervene properly, and they will intervene, you know, when it gets a little rough. And so with that being said, again, we want to thank you for joining us on this podcast. This has just been, you know, one of our passions, Terry and I. I just am so intrigued by litigation and attorneys and the thought process. Respect it highly and learn from them a lot. And so, you know, please go visit Beyond the Mask website and give us a like, give us a thumbs up, or maybe you didn't like it, thumbs down, or, you know, and give us some comments. What would you like to see on future episodes? You know, the goal here is from a clinical standpoint, making sure that you're getting novel, unique content. It's not all about, you know, how much dexmedetomidine do I give on induction and stuff like that? You know, now we can talk about that, but it's a little redundant. We want to push the envelope a little bit for you.
Yeah.
So with that, again, thank you so much. And to my esteemed colleague here, Dr. Terry Wicks, it's just been a pleasure. And we will speak to you on the next podcast of...
See you around.
All right. Take care.
Out here.
Bye now.
Bye.
Hi, this is Jackie Rolls, president of the International Federation of Nurse Anesthetists and president and founder of Our Hearts, Your Hands, a global anesthesia support community that takes donations to allow nurse anesthetists in low and middle income countries to go to educational programs, buy equipment, or textbooks. Your donations are tax deductible, and we would appreciate your support.
Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere you like to listen to shows. Also, be sure to check out beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Each episode is posted there with a corresponding blog post, and we timestamp important parts of the episode to help you quickly get to the content you're looking for. Also, check out the special series section on the site. You can follow along and catch up on the CRNA History Series, episodes specifically about political conversations in the industry, or try the CRNA Personal Finance Series. It's all on beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And if you have a question for the show or want to be a guest or even suggest a particular topic, fill out the contact form on the site or send an email directly to us at info@beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And lastly, let's take the conversation social. Check out our Beyond the Mask podcast Facebook page and Facebook group.